From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Asma Khalid. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, 5,000 Haitians living in Massachusetts could be sent back to Haiti.
I think this is like taking 5,000 people from anywhere and just ripping them out of a society. That's not going to be helpful.
Also, Evan Horowitz, the Globe's data wonk, says what you think about the economy in the heartland is probably wrong. Plus, meet Dr. Rox Anderson from MGH. He's the man who invented laser hair removal.
It was really the first study was done in human beings. Mm-hmm. And I was one of the subjects. And I still have a bald spot on my arm.
And cybersecurity expert Susan Landau on protecting your privacy.
I have known, my colleagues have known for years, that anything we don't want on the front page of the New York Times or the Washington Post, we don't put an email.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Asma Khalid. We'll begin with news today that directly affects nearly 5,000 Haitians living in Massachusetts and almost 60,000 Haitians across the country. The Trump administration announced last night that temporary protected status, also known as TPS, for Haitians in the United States will expire on July 22, 2019. The program has allowed eligible Haitians to live and work legally in the U.S. because of unsafe conditions in their home country. Senior administration officials say that conditions on the ground in Haiti have improved significantly since the 2010 earthquake that prompted the country's TPS status. WBUR reporter Shannon Dooling joins us now to talk about what this decision could mean here in Massachusetts. Hi, Shannon.
Hey, Asma.
So, Shannon, it seems like this was expected, right? To some degree, we knew that an announcement about the future of TPS for Haitians and specifically was coming. But does the government's actual decision come as a surprise to you?
Well, sort of yes and no. I mean, there's been this sort of foreshadowing from the Trump administration when it comes to TPS, which is, of course, designed to be a temporary status. A few weeks ago, the administration announced the end of TPS for Nicaragua and Honduras, and sort of following suit with the president's broader immigration platform, right? He said he wants to crack down and reevaluate programs like TPS. So we have been expecting this decision. Back in May, the program for Haiti was extended until January 22nd, 2018.
Okay.
Right. And so we've had that date in mind, and many of the Haitians in the community that I've spoken with have been focused on that January 22nd date. And so here we are about 60 days out from January 22nd, and Haitians with TPS are being told the program is over, but you don't need to leave in January. And so this is where I heard some advocates and some community members almost sounding relieved, right? Because they've had this January date in mind. Now the government says, we'll give you an extra 18 months to sort of get your affairs in order. Now you have until July 22nd, 2019. So maybe that means exploring other immigration statuses available to them. Maybe for some people, they may need to figure out if they even have a home to go back to in Haiti.
Back in Haiti. Oh, wow. So it sounds like there's sort of mixed emotions, right? Because people feel slightly relieved. You're saying that there is this slight sort of additional window. I know that you've been reporting on TPS and also speaking with people who are living here in Massachusetts with this temporary status. Can you give me a sense of who's going to be affected by this decision?
Yeah. So Greater Boston is actually home to the nation's third largest Haitian diaspora. So this is a really vibrant, really large community here. There are around 40,000 Haitians living in Massachusetts. Of those, almost 5,000 are here legally with TPS. And you have to keep in mind that some of these people are here with this temporary status, but they've been here for years. They've had U.S. citizen children here. They own homes, some of them. They have work authorization. They pay taxes. So there are going to be some really difficult decisions coming for some of these families, where you find different family members with different immigration statuses under the same household. I mean, do they separate the family? Do they all move back to Haiti? I mean, these are things that they're going to have to be thinking about. Another factor we should mention is the huge importance of immigrants, especially Haitians here with TPS, in our labor force, and specifically in healthcare. State Senator Linda Dorsina-Forey, who herself is the daughter of Haitian immigrants, is expecting the state's healthcare sector to take a hit from this decision.
there's going to be an impact when we look at the healthcare sector, when we look at home health aides, when we look at those that are working in hospitals. A lot of them have TPS.
Shannon, that's so interesting. You know, over on the biz tech team, we've actually specifically looked at the home healthcare aid sector, and that's expected to be the largest growth industry in the Massachusetts economy.
Exactly.
And so here you are talking about
the numbers are staggering.
Yeah. Just a population that really works there extensively, mm-hmm, right? So that can really also take a toll on the economy.
Mm-hmm.
So what is next? I mean, is there an appeals process or even a possibility that the deadline date could be extended again?
Well, there's no sort of individual appeal for Haitians to pursue. Mm. This is federal immigration policy. So the states have little influence over remedies. So any pathway to sort of permanent residency or citizenship for Haitian TPS recipients has to come from Congress. And
I see.
Yeah. And in fact, Acting Homeland Security Secretary Elaine Duke is supportive of Congress stepping in to take this action. Our own Massachusetts Congressman Michael Capuano believes our state's delegation can maybe lead on this issue.
But we will do everything we can, and we'll do it as hard as we can. And in the past, we have had some formulas for success in different areas. The Massachusetts delegation is pretty good at what we do. Nonetheless, we are clearly struggling uphill.
So, Shannon, I understand what you're saying about a possible federal remedy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I also am a little confused sort of as to what happens to people. You said there's no individual remedy in any way, but mm-hmm. these folks could potentially transition, you were saying, into some other legal status. And how would that happen?
Right, right. So just because someone has a TPS status right now uh-huh. does not mean that they are, specifically eligible for a certain additional immigration status. Having TPS doesn't enable you to get
a green card.
Right, exactly. Yeah. It doesn't make you any more likely to get a green card or a visa. But because so many of these people have been living in the country for so long, the chances are maybe they have, maybe they've married a U.S. citizen by now. Maybe their child is of a certain age and is eligible to sponsor them to become a citizen or a green card holder. So there might be some of those remedies available to folks, and immigration advocates say they'll be working with the community to explore some of these options. But as of July 22nd, 2019, TPS status for Haitians will no longer exist.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Asma.
That's WBUR's Shannon Dooling. Now, when looking at a map of the 2016 U.S. presidential election, the geographic political pattern is clear. Middle America and the South largely went to President Donald Trump, while the coasts largely went to Hillary Clinton. For many, this reason was, very clear. After the election, actually, when I was covering politics at NPR, I visited Ohio and I met David Beatrice. He's the chairman of the Democratic Party in Mahoning County. It's an area that usually votes Democratic.
I told the campaign they were in trouble with blue-collar workers and that if they didn't retool their message, that they were not only going to lose Ohio, but that they were going to lose Pennsylvania and Michigan.
Beatrice told me that in spite of Trump's ostentatious wealth, he connected more effectively with working-class folks who needed jobs. But in a recent article for the Boston Globe, Evan Horowitz, a Quick Study columnist, takes issue with this common view that Trump won because of economic hardship in middle America. Evan, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Amazing to be here with you, Asma.
So, Evan, let's start with this map you compiled of the change in per capita income by county across the United States. It seems like it showed the change from 1980 to 2015. Can you give us a quick recap for folks who haven't seen the piece, what you found?
Sure. And I should say, first off, I also was surprised. Like, the goal was not, you said I took issue with this. I actually set out to show that it was true and found that it wasn't true. It's obviously most effective to describe maps on the radio.
All right, I know.
So let's just do it that
visually
way.
Describe
yeah.
it, folks.
So, imagine a map of the United States with the darkest red areas being the ones with the most income growth.
Mm-hmm.
What you see are the darkest red areas in the middle of the country, in a line running from North Dakota to Texas,
mm-hmm.
and then across the South. Those are the counties nationwide that have seen the fastest income growth over the last generation. Not counties along the coast, which is what I expected to see, and I think what the cliched narrative would suggest.
So you were looking at percent change, is that right?
So yeah, this is the, just throw aside the technical stuff. What I'm looking at is how much more money do people have in a given county than they had a generation ago?
I guess the reason I'm asking that, though, Evan, is because, right, like if you look at a county, say, like, you know, Mississippi, right? And I actually sort of went back and looked at some of these counties over time. And so the median household income in a place like Mississippi in the 1980s, it was like 34,000 some. Now it's relatively, you know, 39,000 some. So they were starting, I mean, it sounds crude, but they're starting at like an F, right? And you get up to a D level. Whereas if you're looking at a place like Massachusetts or California, you're starting at as an A. So it feels to me like if you're starting at a really low level and you're improving a bit,
all right, well, let's go back, because I love a question like this. This is great. It's true. I'm not looking at where people are now. Okay, uh-huh. This is true. I'm not looking at who's rich and who's poor. I'm looking at how much change there's been. And one of the reasons for that is I think the narrative around – a lot of the narrative around the Trump wave has been that it's about economic stagnation. It's about communities that don't see a future. It's about communities that have been left behind. For those kinds of questions, change is what you want to know about. Are these communities improving or are they stuck? So that's why mm-hmm. I'm looking at change. The other thing is I – checked this because I had mm-hmm. a couple people ask me about this. There is no connection between whether you started poor and whether you saw a lot of growth. Absolutely none. Poor counties did not see more growth than rich counties. The counties that saw the most growth were those in the middle of the country, not those that started off poor. There, you can find counties where that's true, but that's not the pattern.
And so, okay, I have two quick questions
please.
This one. So one is, I mean, I get what you're saying, right, in terms of looking at percent change. But if you do look at, let's say, like, collectively a state, right, we look at Mississippi and we look at Massachusetts and we look at per capita income growth, they're relatively similar, right? Let's say like a 15% change in one and 18% change roughly in the other. But they're starting off at such diametrically opposed places. And maybe this is states versus counties, right?
No, but it's not. It would also be true at counties. Counties in Mississippi are clearly starting a different place. But again, the question is about, are those counties being left behind? Mm-hmm. Have they been left behind?
But if everybody's
was America
growing.
Great a generation ago
uh-huh.
in a way that it isn't? And I think I expected to find what you're suggesting, that actually the places that were great and aren't any longer are the places that went for Trump. But no. And when you look at what has changed, the places that have seen the biggest improvements since America was supposed to, just in the last generation, are places that went, well, that are in the middle of the country. They're not coastal places.
Okay,
so true.
Describe to me, what you're talking about by middle real quick.
So this is the thing. And I think one of the confusions here is that it's very tempting to assume that the Midwest is the middle.
Uh-huh.
And
I accept that as a native Midwesterner.
Well, as someone who's lived in Texas, where it is the middle but not the Midwest, it's easy to forget this. But so the cliche version is actually true mostly of the Midwest. The Midwest mm-hmm. has not seen economic growth since
and that's what we had, like, David Beatrice in that intro, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that doesn't surprise me at all. In Ohio, you do have people who have gone a generation without seeing real economic growth, who've been hit hard by China. And that's true of the Midwest. It's just that you can't simply go, oh, it's true of the Midwest, therefore it's true of everything between the coasts in America. That is, it's true of everywhere in inland America. It's not true of everywhere in inland America. North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, down to Texas have seen enormous growth, some of it from fracking, but some of it before fracking. And the South, so all along the Gulf from Texas to Florida, has seen incredible economic diversification, chiefly in the 80s and 90s, but extending here, with higher growth rates than in California or higher growth rates than you've seen in New York or New Jersey. So I think I also was surprised. It's funny to be defending this position because it's not at all what I expected, and I don't have any sort of ideological reason to defend this position. It's just what the numbers show, that if you look at which counties have really done well economically, where people have more money than they did a generation ago, they're in the middle, the dead middle of the country, not the Midwest, and they're not meaningfully correlated with votes for Donald Trump.
So what explanations of the growth did you find? You mentioned fracking a bit.
Yeah, so fracking has been a major factor the last 10 years or so, which has caused a big oil boom in North Dakota and South Dakota, parts of Texas and Pennsylvania. But even if you leave out the fracking years, the map looks really similar. If you look at income growth from 1980 to, say, 2004, 2005, before the fracking boom really took off. And the big impact seems to be some shift of manufacturing west out of the Midwest into North Dakota, Texas. And then, even more important, diversification and the growth of the service sector. Across the South, there's been a massive increase in the number of higher-skill service sector jobs over the last generation. Think business-to-business jobs, consulting jobs, insurance jobs, advertising jobs, things like that. And that's made the biggest difference. And that's true of New England, too. I mean, I'm talking about the middle because I think that's the surprising thing about mm-hmm. this. But actually, the one coastal area that has done really well is right here. It's Massachusetts, Vermont, it's New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. We actually have seen a tremendous amount of growth, much more than you find in other coastal areas. So, I mean, you can feel good about that in Massachusetts. I don't think it breaks the surprising pattern, though.
So what are some of the political conclusions that you drew? It seems like you're very skeptical of this idea that economic hardship equals votes for Trump. Right? Like that narrative you take issue with.
I would phrase it differently. I would say I have become very skeptical because uh-huh. I went looking for evidence and couldn't find it. So I'm growing skeptical of it. And I think, you know, you would have to see it there. If mm-hmm. economic stagnation were a primary engine of support for Donald Trump, there should be a basic correlate. If you should be able to say, oh, look at this county. Has there been growth there? And if the answer is yes, mm-hmm. they should have fewer votes for Trump. And maybe there'll be exceptions. But if you look at 1,000 counties, that's what you should see. And you don't see it. Okay. There's absolutely no statistical correlation between growth over the last generation and votes for Trump.
So can I ask you, okay, so
but there is,
I get what you're saying there.
There is a correlation between, well, other things that people realize.
Race,
but yes, like,
you were saying, yeah.
Race is a big factor. If you have
and
a
that's
large...
no surprise, right? I mean, like, we saw many poor black and brown voters not vote for Donald Trump. So...
Yeah, I mean, what is surprising is the sort of specificity of it, I think. That mm-hmm. is, there seems to be a kind of tipping point if your county is 85% white or more.
Hmm.
That is, if you're majority white, that's not necessarily telling, but you
now
reach a tipping point where yeah. you get to a high level, and then Trump support really shoots up. Same with the connection with education, too. White number of high school grads, that's a correlation you see everywhere. And you saw it in Massachusetts. Massachusetts is a very strong, even here, town-by-town connection between the number of white high school grads and support for Donald Trump.
So, Evan, I understand what you're saying about the Dakotas on down south to Texas, all right?
I feel like a used car salesman. I'm like, what do I have to do to get you into this argument today? No.
But no. I guess I understand what you're saying about the economic correlation. But I guess I'm having a difficult time taking that economic correlation and translating it into the political map that we saw of 2016. In part, right, because if you look at both North and South Dakota, the last time they voted for a Democratic candidate was Lyndon B. Johnson. Texas, you'd have to go back to the 1970s. So these are Republican states through and through. And in your own writing, you acknowledge that it is the Midwest that has struggled economically. And I would make the case as a political reporter that it's Ohio, Pennsylvania even, Wisconsin and Michigan that lost Hillary Clinton this election. And take those four states out, and frankly, nothing else really matters in the Electoral College, right?
Yeah. So I think at the state level, it's very hard to see what's going on, which is one reason it helps to look at the county level.
Hmm.
Because at the county level, you really do see that these things matter. It's true those states that you say shifted the Electoral College.
And some of them traditionally went Democrat.
Yeah. So there are purple states, right? But at the county level, you really do see this pattern where even the counties that flipped. So, you know, take your account. You want to look at the counties that flipped. Maybe that's the most interesting thing.
Sure.
Even among the counties that flipped, it's not counties, obviously can't be counties that were always red, right?
Uh-huh.
Because they flipped by definition.
Sure.
And you would think maybe economics is a big connector there, but it's not.
Mm-hmm.
It's not there. Even again, even if you just really focus on that. So I should qualify that. There is an economic factor for counties that flip. If you don't adjust for geography, like because a lot of the counties that flipped are in the Midwest.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And because the Midwest is an area that really didn't see any economic growth, then you do end up with this where like lots of towns that didn't see economic growth did go more for Trump. But it's actually, seems to me, not an economic function. If it were an economic function, it would be happening in other places because there are counties, say, farther west that didn't flip that also had no growth. So there are counties... There are an equal number of counties outside of the Midwest. The big function there, big factor there is, are you in the Midwest and struggling, not have you struggled
so
over
the last
years?
So maybe perhaps it's like a confluence of different factors, right? Because in the Midwest, there could be an economic justification, it sounds like you're saying. But maybe if you're in North Dakota or Texas, it sounds like...
But I don't think it works to parse it out. I mean, I love this argument.
Totally.
This is too much but I don't know that it works to parse it out this way, because if it is a function of economics, you shouldn't just see it in the Midwest. I mean,
true.
If economics is what matters, you should see it
I
everywhere.
Hear you, yeah.
And I guess my point is, I looked everywhere.
You should have seen
that's
it across
why
racial
I wanted
lines,
to look. Yeah,
right?
That's why I wanted to look everywhere, because I wanted to see. Well, we should see it everywhere. If this is what's going on, we should see it everywhere. And we don't really see it everywhere. There are plenty of places that not just voted for Trump, but shifted towards Trump, and did so despite the fact that they've seen really, really strong economic growth for 30 years.
Gosh. Well, loads to think about. Thank you so much, Evan. I have gone over the time limit, so I'm going to have to close it there. That's Evan Horowitz, at the Boston Globe's Quick Study columnist. Thanks again for joining us.
This was great. Thank you, Asma.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Asma Khalid. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Asma Khalid. So as most of you probably know, my day job when I'm not filling in for Meghna is leading Bostonomics. That's WBUR's new biz and tech team. And one thing I've been experimenting with is co-reporting some stories with my NPR colleague, Aarti Shahani. She's based in Silicon Valley. We're both fascinated with beauty tech. It's this multi-million dollar industry that isn't traditionally seen as tech. Now, Aarti and I are also both South Asian women, and as any brown woman can tell you, hair, body hair, and figuring out how to get rid of unwanted hair is kind of a cultural obsession. Waxing, tweezing, threading, we have pretty much tried it all. And so naturally, when laser hair removal came out, we both also tried it. And we're not alone. In fact, laser hair removal is one of the most popular non-invasive cosmetic procedures in the country. Last year, it was performed over 1 million times. So when we found out the man who invented laser hair removal, Dr. Rox Anderson, is based here in Boston at Mass General Hospital, we sought him out for an interview. We met in his office, where the walls are lined with patents, many related to lasers. And we began with a basic question. What is a laser?
Most people have a gut feeling for what a laser is. It's a very bright source of light, that the light is somehow a pure color, and the output is as a beam. So the characteristics of lasers are you can focus a lot of power, you can get these short pulses. It's literally the most powerful light sources we have on Earth, so we can concentrate that light. What's in the guts of a laser is really interesting. The quantum of light is called a photon. And inside the laser, the photons are literally being amplified at the molecular level.
So how do you do that?
Well, this came from Einstein, our good old friend Albert, long ago, about a century ago, had a theoretical prediction that you could take an excited atom and tickle it to emit a photon, that one photon could beget another photon. So you go from one to two, and then two to four, and four to eight, and it's an exponential process.
So a laser is an accumulation of excited atoms that you're tickling.
It starts with the excited atoms, but the excited atoms produce photons of light, and they act as an amplifier.
But what's being tickled?
The excited atom is tickled by a photon to create an identical photon.
So the
laser is actually an acronym. It stands for light amplified by stimulated emission of radiation. L-A-S-E-R.
I never knew that.
That's, wow. Right.
I thought laser is like one of those words in the Merriam-Webster dictionary.
I assume it had some Greek root. I thought it was just a Greek root word.
Well, I think it.
Or Latin.
I haven't looked it up for a long time.
It probably is in the dictionary
I think
now.
It probably is a real word, but it is an acronym word. First laser was invented in 1960. And it was a ruby laser, a large ruby crystal pumped with a energy from a flash lamp. And if you want to see that, that's sitting in the Smithsonian Institute.
Huh.
What's interesting about laser hair removal, we did it 30 years, more than 30 years after the invention of the ruby laser. And the first laser we used was a ruby laser.
So it's red, the ruby laser. Why isn't it violet?
To do laser hair removal, we had to pick a wavelength that was preferentially absorbed by the pigment melanin, which is what gives your hair the color it has. Mm-hmm. It's also, in a way, unfortunately, what gives your skin the color it has. So we had to figure out a way to sneak photons through the skin down into the where the hair follicle is. And it turns out that red and near-infrared wavelengths can do that. You get enough absorption in the hair without hurting the overlying pigmented skin.
So just so I'm clear, you're saying that this red laser, right, would be able to correctly kind of penetrate your skin and identify, it would be absorbed by the hair follicle without really hurting or burning your skin.
Yeah, depending on other conditions.
Ideally.
So if you're very, very dark skin, that it's a challenge to do laser hair removal in somebody who's really very dark skinned. But it's even worse of a challenge to do laser hair removal in someone who has very light hair. And we do all sorts of things to favor the hair damage, not the skin damage. Unfortunately, in dark-skinned people, sometimes that's probably the major, one of the major side effects of laser hair removal. If you're darker skinned, we have to turn the lasers down. You have to cool the surface of the skin and so forth.
Just walk us through, Rox. Where were you when you discovered, oh, I can use a laser to do this?
Especially because you said the technology had already been out there,
yeah,
right? It wasn't
sure.
like you developed this new technology. You figured out it could do something that nobody else had ever really thought of before.
Yeah, tell sure. us the story of how that happened.
Well, it's actually a good story because I never would have done this if it weren't for a woman named Melanie Grossman, who came up to work with me from New York City, and she was working with me on some other projects. And whenever I bring somebody new, young doctor, into the lab to be trained, I only tell them sort of what to do with half their time. The other half, I say, well, what do you want to do? She said, well, I would like to do laser hair removal. My response, of course, was, why would you ever want to do that?
Was she hairy?
No, she wasn't particularly hairy. And she kind of, you know, stared at me like, you know, I was a Martian. Because, I mean, frankly, it just wasn't even on my mind. If it wasn't for Melanie, I never would have done it. And, in fact, all good things often will start this way, where it's the problem that leads you on your path to discovery and then finally success, as opposed to some new technology. So the laser had been around for 30 years. I owned one in the lab for many, many years prior to ever doing this project. And what we did was we basically started looking at the structure of hair follicles in people, how much pigment is in there. Our first patients were hairy dogs, not hairy people.
Huh.
Black-haired dogs. So we made some
hair. Like labs or what?
Oh, I can't even remember what they were. Okay. This is more than 20 years ago.
Okay.
And I have dogs. I love dogs. Right? But we didn't. No dogs were harmed in the process.
Uh-huh.
Some of them just might lose some hair.
Yeah,
lose some hair.
But we quickly.
Maybe shamed, but not harmed. Sorry.
Yeah, perhaps continue. In the dog world, yeah.
Yeah.
But we quickly moved it toward people. The actual first paper that came out, I think it was 1994. It was really the first study was done in human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And I was one of the subjects. And I
really?
Still have a bald spot on my arm.
Can we see?
because when we got this to the FDA, you know, the FDA approves new devices and drugs, and we weren't sure what to call it. And there was a big debate about whether this would be permanent or not.
But were you ever concerned, like, maybe this will cause skin cancer too?
There's always a risk. I mean, I think there's nothing here on this planet that's risk-free.
Mm-hmm.
but this is visible light that we're exposed to every day. The sun has got plenty of red light in it. It's just that we're putting a lot of it in at a short period of time. So I'm happy to say there have been many millions of patients treated for laser hair removal, and it's not associated at all with producing cancer.
So, Rox, when you did that first little square patch on your arm, two questions. One, what did it feel like?
Mm-hmm.
And two, did you know then what you had created?
It felt like being hit with a rubber band pretty well. And it was actually
Dr. What it feels like now, too.
Yeah. And Dr. Grossman did that to me. I was the first of our subjects in the human trial. And so to answer the second part of your question, this is my version of the golden rule. Do unto yourself before you do unto others. Okay? if I, as a physician and a professor at Harvard Medical School, am willing to put someone else at risk for something like hair removal, I darn well better try it out on myself first. The ethics of that are really interesting. You're not supposed to do self-experimentation, but for something like this, I think it's actually unethical not to.
And the second question.
The second part was, did you know when you did that little patch what you had created?
Oh, yeah. I did not. We were at the beginning, and it takes at least 6 months to be able to see whether the hair will regrow. Human hair has a cycle time. On the head of a woman, it's 10 years, right? On the arm of a man, it's a about 4 months. If you get what I'm saying, there's a clock inside every hair follicle.
Yeah.
And we wanted to make sure that clock was not ticking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I know when I was doing laser, so for me, it worked amazingly well. Mm-hmm. And I would just say completely transformed my self-image.
Great.
So like because I had that combination of, I have a tan right now, but my skin is in general lighter and my hair was very coarse. Mm-hmm. And basically, I did laser, I think, in 2012.
Oh, wow.
I haven't shaved or waxed since then.
Right.
And
oh,
I wear skirts all the time.
Right.
I, like, it just completely changed.
And that's the majority of people have your good experience with that.
Yeah.
But it's sometimes hard to sort out.
And that's the part that I want to get to. What's funny is I almost didn't do it because I looked online and I heard all these horror stories about extra growth, and then you go to like some salon where no one has a medical background, but they want to take your money. And so it's actually like I did it because I was that frustrated, but I literally went into it thinking, am I going to give myself cancer or more hair? I have no idea.
Or burns. I mean, this was another thing that happened. Yeah. I had a friend who got burns. And these are all people who had somewhat of the, you know, darker skin complexion.
As I was saying, the darker the skin, the more difficult it is. And, you know, it's even in good hands, people will have skin burns with laser hair removal.
If I'm someone who's thinking about laser hair removal, who's a good candidate for this? Who isn't a good candidate for this? What should you watch out for?
Yeah, those are great questions. So good candidates are people with dark hair and fair skin in which the hair is coarse. And the bad candidates are the opposite. They're people with dark skin and fair hair. There aren't too many of those. But when people, particularly women, when you hit menopause, a little nasty combination of things happens, which is your estrogen levels go down. And at the same time, your hair is turning white. And so some women will grow facial hair suddenly at menopause, and it's white. And don't be fooled. There is no laser or IPL that can remove white hair.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's not a good candidate for this treatment either.
Mm-hmm. And what about dark-skinned women with dark hair?
I think that's fine, but it needs to be done in expert hands. And that's where, in a way, you're skating on thin ice because it's easy to damage the dark skin.
If you're, for example, I have black girlfriends and guy friends who have like horrible problems with ingrown hair and would love to do laser, but they're like, there's no one good for me on that. Like, I can't do laser. Is that true?
Which is not true. So typically the African-American community has really dark hair, right? And the ingrown hairs, that's what that's called, is pseudofolliculitis barbae. Isn't that a great name? PFB, we call it.
Mm-hmm.
So people with that condition, they have all this inflammation going on from the ingrown hairs. And that actually leads to even darker skin. So I have no trouble treating those people, and I get great results. But it's not trivial. I can't tell you how many black guys who ruin their faces, they have scarring and so forth from shaving closely, but you can't just walk in and start blazing away with the laser. You have to precondition them, and then they do great.
When you devised this, you know, in the beginning it was introduced largely through dermatology practices, it seems like. It's now a highly commercialized product. Does that bother you? What do you feel about the sort of hyper-commercialization of this technology that you created?
Yeah, number one, it doesn't bother me at all. I don't really work for dermatologists. I work for patients. I work for people. And as long as it's being done properly, in good hands, you know, and it's valuable, that's fine with me. And I think it's kind of surprising how popular this has become. I think that
you didn't think it would be?
Well, who knows? But I think now, you know, we're looking at more than 20 years after the original
work.
What
do you think when you see the ads or hear the ads?
Well, I try to ignore them.
Really?
But I mean, you see them anyway, and I say, oh, that's fine. I don't advertise, by the way. I don't need to. But I guess what I was going to say is that it's now been more than two decades. There are multiple companies, multiple countries all over the world. It's clearly here to stay, and I feel proud about that. I think it's certainly helping, you know, a lot of people. And I was surprised when I was reading that it's the number one non-surgical cosmetic procedure.
The final question I have, Rox, of all the ways that you've used a laser, which one are you the most proud of?
Ooh, that's a great question.
That is a good question. I echo that.
I have to say it's probably the first thing that got me interested in this, which is treating babies with these vascular malformations, these port wine stains, which are really common.
I'm having a hard time understanding.
It's a red birthmark, basically. They're common enough. It's about
like a mole, almost a red birthmark.
Yeah, it's red, okay. and not brown. Most so-called moles are brown or black. These are common. It's about 1 in 300 people that are born with them. They can be quite devastating. They can involve the brain. They can involve the eye. You get glaucoma.
So it's not purely cosmetic.
Absolutely not. Yeah. And then over time, they actually darken and get larger and can cause problems. So you sort of replace a birthmark with a burn scar. And, you know, I'm really very proud of that because we not only came up with a theory, but built a laser, showed that it worked, got it through the FDA, and that is still the only way we treat these kids, right?
Wow.
And what year was this?
86 or something like that. I don't know what it is about me. I just love kids. Before I went to med school, I used to run a summer camp. I love my own kids. I love your kids too, right? So
no kids yet.
I like that one, not just because it worked well and it's lasted and it's kind of become the gold standard, but because in fact, you know, there is no other option and it's all about little children.
That was Dr. Rox Anderson, the man who invented laser hair removal. He was speaking with me and my NPR colleague, Aarti Shahani, in his office at Mass General Hospital. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Asma Khalid, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Asma Khalid. Finally today, let's talk about how secure your phone is. We're joined in studio by Susan Landau. She's a professor of cybersecurity at the Fletcher School at Tufts. She was formerly an engineer at Sun Microsystems and a privacy analyst at Google. But what many people also know her for is testifying in front of the House Judiciary Committee on Encryption, specifically the Apple versus the FBI case. A quick recap here, in case that case doesn't ring a bell. You might remember that following the attack in San Bernardino, in 2015, federal authorities recovered an iPhone used by the shooter. However, it was locked by a 4-digit password. When the FBI asked Apple to create software that would enable them to unlock the iPhone, Apple said no. Here's CEO Tim Cook in an interview with ABC News in February of 2016.
This case is not about one phone. This case is about the future. What is at stake here is, can the government compel Apple to write software that we believe would make hundreds of millions of customers vulnerable around the world, including the U.S.
The dispute went to court, but before the hearings could begin, the FBI announced they'd found another way to unlock the phone. However, the debate continues. Just yesterday, Texas law enforcement served Apple with a search warrant for iCloud data on the phone belonging to the gunman from the Sutherland Springs attack. Susan Landau addresses law enforcement access to our iPhones and other cybersecurity issues in her new book. It's called Listening In, Cybersecurity in an Insecure Age. And Susan, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks very much for having me.
So, Susan, I want to begin with some of the latest news. We mentioned just briefly in the intro here the situation with law enforcement trying to obtain essentially data from the shooter involved in Sutherland Springs. And can you give us a sense of what's really going on? We saw earlier a report from Reuters
that the FBI didn't really ask Apple for assistance during that immediate 48-hour window, which if this phone had, you know, Touch ID enabled, you maybe could have potentially used the gunman's fingerprints.
So we don't actually know what we don't know why the FBI, why law enforcement actually wants data from the phone, because, of course, we know who the shooter was. Mm-hmm. And we also know, of course, a lot of history of the shooter and his violent behavior earlier. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of explanations about the shooter. But in terms of the phone itself, the question I have is, are they asking for data from the phone or are they asking for data from the cloud? If the warrant is really about data from the cloud, then it makes sense to have a warrant. If the warrant is for data from the phone, then I am wondering more than a little, is this really more about coming back to Apple with yet another case, a violent, ugly case?
I see. So, you know, why don't law enforcement officials essentially use the same method that they used in the San Bernardino case, which was to hack the phone?
Because it's a different model, presumably, a different time. Mm. One thing is when the FBI got ability to go in to get into the San Bernardino phone, they got the ability to get into that phone. They didn't actually purchase the vulnerability that would let them get into other phones.
I see.
Of course, Apple in the interim has updated phones and may have taken care of the insecurity there to begin with.
So, Susan, you testified that Apple should not be forced to create essentially a backdoor option. This was a while ago in regards to the previous case we mentioned. And why is that? What concerns do you have about this, quote, backdoor option?
Sure. Thank you for asking that. That's actually a very important issue. So Apple argued the case on two bases, on a legal base and on an issue of security. My concern as a computer security person was that if you're going to use the update mechanism to unlock phones, and at the time, originally Director Comey said he had one phone. During the testimony, he said, well, he had more like a dozen. Cy Vance, the DA from Manhattan, had hundreds, and by now FBI says they have thousands. I think the latest number was about 7,000.
Oh, wow.
When you have that many phones, what you're doing is a security or an insecurity update to each phone, each of the phones they have, on a daily basis. You're involving lots of people in the process, and you're taking a process that was automated and quite secure by introducing people, a lawyer and an engineer, to make sure that the right phone gets the insecurity update. When you introduce that many people, you're going to make a process insecure. And that's very dangerous.
So you mentioned briefly there former FBI Director James Comey. He testified in front of the House Judiciary Committee last year about why the FBI needs access to phones. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
The problem we face here is all of our lives are on these devices, which is why it's so important that they be private. But that also means all of criminals and pedophiles and terrorists' lives are on these devices. And if they can't, if they're warrant proof, even a judge can't order access to a device, that is a big problem.
Your response, Susan?
So one of my colleagues, an ex-NSA person, said to me once, you know, the law gives us access to particular information. The law doesn't say anything about it being easy. The FBI, and in particular Director Comey, kept characterizing the issue as a privacy versus security issue. I don't think it's a privacy versus security issue. I think with the kind of data we have on the phones, with the fact that we often use phones as what we call second factor authenticators, something you carry with you to authenticate yourself to an online account, both of those argue for making phones more secure, not less secure. And in fact, that's why Apple, starting in the late 2000s, began moving in the direction of securing data on the phone with a user's password PIN number.
I want to play just one more clip here. This is John Miller. He's a Deputy Commissioner of Intelligence and Counterterrorism of the NYPD. We heard from him on CBS last year, sort of suggesting that a phone shouldn't be seen differently as other places where we keep private information.
There's no bank. There's no safe company. There's no vault. There is no apartment. There's no door that can't be penetrated with a lawful order from a U.S. court.
So, I mean, Susan, should a phone be different, and should the FBI need to sort of take special steps in order to get access to information on a phone? What would be acceptable to you?
So the real issue is how we secure ourselves against everybody else. When you make it an issue of law enforcement being able to get into the phone versus somebody wanting to keep data private, it's one story. But when you make it an issue of law enforcement being able to access the phone and therefore weakening the security of the phone, enabling criminals, other nation states, other bad actors to get in, it becomes a completely different story. And that's the story that law enforcement seems unable to understand.
Are we seeing sort of more automatic encryption at this point by companies? I mean, you mentioned that one of the reasons law enforcement can't necessarily hack the phone in a similar way with the current case in Sutherland Springs is because, phones have updates and we're seeing additional changes there. So have we seen, I would say, additional measures specifically taken around encryption?
Absolutely. And there have been two sets of them. The first one was, as I mentioned, Apple started securing the phone beginning in the late 2000s. There was a group of Chinese criminals that had learned how to open phones and take data off the phones, email and other data, which they then used for identity theft and other kinds of fraud. And then they took their product, and they sold it abroad so that other people could take misplaced, lost, or stolen phones and steal data off the phones and then commit fraud. When Apple saw this, what Apple did was created a way first to protect your email with a combination of the PIN, the password that you put in, and data on a key on the phone. And they did that in 2011. Several years later, they started encrypting all the other information. So that's one security step. The other security step is encrypting communications, which is something that has been happening for a while and picked up actually after the DNC hack last summer. And we found that, in fact, people in Congress and people in the political world, Obama's people, Clinton's people, Trump's people, started using end-to-end encryption for their communications. That meant that not only couldn't an eavesdropper hear their communications or learn anything they said when it was intercepted, but it also meant that the communications weren't stored so that somebody who stole them didn't have anything.
You mentioned the DNC hack, and that's something else that you talked about quite a bit in the book that I wanted to shift gears to. The hack specifically of the DNC during the Clinton campaign, we saw that there were John Podesta's emails essentially that were hacked. This was done through phishing emails. What worries you about that particular case?
What worries me is not so much the theft of the emails, but the way they were used, delivered to WikiLeaks and drip, drip, drip through the campaign, and it undoubtedly had an effect on the campaign. What we've seen over the last year or two is not only in the U.S., but in Germany, now apparently also in the U.K., in France, efforts by Russia to disrupt democracies, to disrupt civil society by creating dissent, by working against candidates. And we had always worried for a long time about what people called a cyber Pearl Harbor, an attack on critical infrastructure, somebody shutting off the lights in Boston or shutting off the power grid in the West Coast.
Yeah.
Instead, the attack is more subtle, but also an attack that the Russians are quite experienced at, disinformation, political disruption, disruption to civil society. And it worries me a great deal because, one, we haven't responded adequately to the Russians, but two, we're really not equipped to handle it.
The actual hack itself, Susan, it seems like it was not particularly sophisticated, but it worked, right? And it worked really efficiently for the Russians' purposes.
That's right.
Is this the type of hack that we could likely see a lot more of in the future?
Absolutely. And in fact, at the time when the Office of Director of National Intelligence last January issued an unclassified report saying, yes, there'd been Russian hacking in the campaign, they also said there'd been hacking attempts against think tanks and other organizations likely to influence U.S. public policy. I spoke with some civil society groups in Washington at the time, and some of them had been the subject of attacks.
Do you see that there are steps that we can take at this point, be it either on a sort of a national defense perspective or individually, to protect ourselves from this?
There are many steps we can take.
Okay,
the question is whether we're going to have the will to do it and also trade convenience for security. So on the national level, as I said, I don't think the U.S. has adequately responded to the Russian attacks. On an individual level, there are many things we can do. One thing, of course, the simplest thing we can do is always update. As soon as you get an update, go to automatic updates for all your systems. Now, that can
that
be quite disruptive because it may break some things. But that is, in fact, the best security step you can take. And it's one of the reasons that using a security un-update the kind of thing that the FBI was asking Apple to do is particularly disruptive because some people will choose not to do automatic updates. The next thing you can do is to be cautious, to be careful. Don't open attachments unless you're sure of the provenance and you're sure that it really is coming from the person you think it's coming from. Don't go to web pages that look questionable. That is, the spelling is wrong. Somebody sends you a link and says, hey, check out this interesting site. But there's also, in terms of what else you choose or don't choose to have on your phone, to have on your devices, which apps you use that are more secure, which ones are not.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Susan. That's all sort of like very basic information that I think we can use on an individual level. So appreciate it. That's Susan Landau. She's professor of cybersecurity at the Fletcher School at Tufts. Her new book is titled Listening In, Cybersecurity in an Insecure Age. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Asma Khalid. This is Radio Boston.